Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show we consider the role of anniversary, commemoration and celebration as we project sharply into the realms of 2015. We take on the milestones of art, pop culture, history and the twists of fate that ratchet up significant mileage in the new year. With me as ever is the totem of cultural shift who never fears the march of progress, the man for whom the world was sold, the intrepid stalker of old Father Time, it's Dave Allen.
Hello, James.
Joining us tonight also is another flash of light on the lining of our cultural cloud. It's research fellow and artist in residence at the University of Portsmouth. It's John Adams.
Hi there, James.
Welcome, John. It's good to have you on board. We've got an interesting theme for a new year, 2015, a new year. I didn't quite believe we got there, but we got there in the end. And we're going to look at anniversaries and really, I suppose, how we reflect and celebrate them or commemorate them, but also why we do. And Dave's going to try and sort of unravel this a bit for us.
Yeah, I think why we do is an interesting element of it. And later on, I'd like to talk a little bit about the nature of nostalgia, which sometimes gets quite bad press. But there's some interesting research work going on at the University of Southampton, actually, which is it's painting a quite positive picture of nostalgia. It came out of the fact that... for those of you that listen regularly and wonder how we decide to do what we decide to do, it's often something that's particularly topical. There might be a project going on, and that indeed is why John's with us tonight to talk about a very specific project. But sometimes we just have a cup of tea in the Guildhall, don't we, and put our heads together and think, what should we talk about? And
we do.
I'd been writing, as I do at this time every year, I'd been finishing off the annual book about Hampshire cricket, and one of the things I always put in are anniversaries, and it just, there were a plethora of them. And one of the interesting ones, actually, even in a cricketing sense, that this year might get a lot of press is the Battle of Waterloo. It's 200 years since the Battle of Waterloo. Why would cricket be interested in that? Well, the simple fact is that in the 18th century, cricket was very big in this part of the country, and Hambledon were one of the most important cricket sides. But by 1805, 1810, 1815, cricket was in complete disarray locally, really. It shifted to London and the MCC and Lords, but there wasn't much cricket being played. And the obvious reason for that, the large proportion of young people from this part of the world who were being conscripted into the army and the navy and whizzed across the channel to fight the French, you know, Napoleon creating havoc in the continent and us going over there and fighting them. And it is quite fascinating if you look at it that there's very little cricket between about 1805 and 1815. And then after 1815, once we've won the Battle of Waterloo, off we go again. Okay, so that might be a good reason to celebrate it. But on the other hand, you know, without wishing to get into very complex political territory, let me say very briefly that, you know, that we're recording this a week after the terrible events in Paris. And we're thinking about celebrating the Battle of Agincourt, which is hundreds of years old this year, and in fact 600 years old, and the Battle of Waterloo, which is 200 years old, while we are almost going over the top in trying to be sympathetic and supportive to the French. So one of the interesting questions is, how are we going to deal with that? You know, are we going to invite the French to come and celebrate their notable defeat at the Battle of Waterloo and the Battle of Agincourt? Or should we... You know, should we moderate the triumphalism of those kinds of things is one of the questions.
Well, let's start, I guess let's start with kind of war and conflict, because I guess of all the commemorations, I think that's the appropriate word, those are the ones that endure, and they endure for different reasons, and they change in terms of how we look back on them. You know, our reflections 200 years on to Waterloo will be quite different 10 or 20 years on from those kind of battles and those... Yes. conflicts. I can remember from a very early age being kind of having it installed in me, if you like, that there are certain things that must be commemorated, that are serious things to consider. There is an argument, I suppose, whether there's too much of this commemoration and whether there's a point at which you stop. Now, I kind of, John, let's bring you in on this.
It's really interesting because, you know, there must be a difference between commemoration and remembrance. You know, some of the events on the list, you know, you're looking at remembering And it's only by looking back at things that you realise, you know, one of two things. A, we can change, or B, things haven't changed and we haven't learned by what's gone in history.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's very powerful, isn't it? The kind of parallels of some of these events, disasters, tragedies, whatever bracket they fall into, but parallels and the lessons that we draw from them. Very often, unfortunately, it's about repetition than it is about learning. And that's that. There's some mixed, I mean, you mentioned some of the events in Paris recently. There's some real kind of mixed messaging in some of the kind of anniversaries we're moving towards. The big ones, you know, the 70th anniversary VJ Day, for example.
VJ,
you know,
and kind of, well, and VE Day. John has just earlier reminded us that, of course, because of that, coincides with the liberation of Auschwitz, which is a really powerful notion. And actually, I might just rush into slightly earlier than I was going to these questions about the significance of nostalgia, because these two quite significant researchers, and I apologise if I pronounce their names incorrectly, Tim Wildschut and Konstantin Sedikaidis, I think they're called, but they're at Southampton University. I'm sure you could find out about them. Wildschut talks about nostalgia and says it compensates for uncomfortable states. For example, people with feelings of meaningless or a discontinuity between the past and the present. He actually has an example, which I think is quite extraordinary, that there is a lot of evidence of women in concentration camps during the Holocaust who responded to starvation in those camps by waxing nostalgic about shared meals with their families and arguing about recipes and so on. So they almost willed themselves into what you might call a pseudo-normal state of living in order to deny the reality of what they were doing, and it was built around nostalgia. And it's one example of how you draw on the past to construct narratives about your life, which includes a narrative about the present. You know, why do we want to construct a narrative about victory in Europe Day? Because there is a kind of nostalgic belief that it was a better time, that the world, you know, you could leave your doors open, nobody would nick your stuff. And a lot of that is myth, you know, it's simply not true. You know, there was a black market, there were people who hadn't gone to war and had dodged it, and so on and so on. But somehow we believe, don't we, in that kind of fundamental goodness of that particular moment and the heroism of those people, that the notion that it was a just war, which I think in many respects, you know, it was. But there's not been a war since then that's been as unproblematic. You know, people now say, you know, should we be going to Iraq? Should we be going to the Falklands? But people didn't, by and large, say, you know, they said the Battle of Britain is a great thing. Even Dunkirk was, in some senses, a great triumph of, you know, of British spirit and so on. And
there is that danger, isn't there, where we are in some of the commemorative activity. I feel that we lapse into perhaps what I would term this kind of postcard snapshot of a time and an era, and you look at the postcard, and you know, any postcard from any seaside resort, if you like, you know, to take an example, you look at that and you think, oh, that's a wonderful place, full of colour and gloss, and you look at it and look at it against the real-time picture of the place. It's very different, and I think the moss, if you like, that gathers in terms of history on events gives it a lot more texture, a lot more flavour, if people eat moss, I'm not sure, but what I'm trying to get to is that there is a danger that there's a stylized image of celebration, but actually there are lots of strands to this. I mean, the Battle of Britain's a good example. You know, the Battle of Britain, people will think about, you know, a kind of archetypal kind of Terry Thomas pilot kind of character, if you like, battling in the skies and, you know, winning it for Blighty against Jerry, but it's actually, you know, a very positive story about engineering and innovation and kind of you know, sort of survival in that, which is kind of lost, I think, with the kind of, you know, the kind of the Spitfire image.
So do we think that, for example, I don't mean this in a negative sense, but the exhausting interest that there has been in the last 12 months in the First World War, I mean, quite extraordinary interest and the number of different kinds of representations, do we think that's given us a more complex and a more profound understanding of a time that nobody actually does remember? There aren't people any longer who can tell you about it. So are we getting them? You know, when they say things like, well, we've got to be careful about this story about the football match because actually, you know, and is that good nostalgia?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're, like you say, we're at the age now where there is no one left alive from the First World War. You know, and our generation is remembering listening to our grandparents or even our parents talking about this. And there are two phrases that come to mind, and they are back in the good old days. Yeah. And also, it must never happen again. Yeah. And those two phrases that are often used are almost poles apart, almost opposites. When we look back at, you know, from 2015 back to 1915, the world was a completely different place. The war was supposed to have been over by Christmas. Mm. It's different. You know, we're looking back with 100 years of added interest and change and whatever. But back in those days, they were looking at, you know, this was the biggest thing that's ever happened. There was no Twitter from the battlefield for people to find out what was going on. And all we have now are the stories that maybe our grandparents or their parents told to us that are passed down.
Yeah.
And you look at the photographs, and James, you're right. You know, you look at these photographs either of the battlefield, which is incomprehensible, or a seaside town, or even, you know, I look back at my photograph when I was about 6 on a beach smiling. You know, there's that, was I happy when I was 6? Yeah. Would I like to go? But it's different. It's completely different. But it's the telling of the story that's important.
Yeah.
There's also, I think, a notion of what I would call living history, in the sense that, you know, you have survivors and you have people who have lived through particular events and, you know, and serious life events, if you like. And at some point, they obviously expire because, you know, people don't live forever. And I think it's really about how those stories are reinterpreted and kept alive, and how they're translated to the kind of current context.
Yeah.
And that's really difficult because, you know, you're relying on a kind of resource that's contracting, if you like, and you can't help but change that story, you know, over 200 years.
Yeah.
You know, that story is different whether you like it or not, you know.
And sometimes time and space actually allow us to get a different view of it. And, you know, again, I'm not wishing to raise anything contentious at the moment, but when the events in Paris of last week occurred, I simply latched onto all the news reports on television, and I read it, everything in the, you know, the broadsheet series, as it were, so-called serious papers and so on and so on and so on. It was very difficult, you know. We are all, you know, we sit around this table, we're professional people in the south of England, you know, and so on and so on and so on. Very difficult to find within that kind of liberal consensus within the mass media and so on, much dissension from a very particular view of condemnation, you know.
Yep.
Was there anything, you know, is there a case to be made for saying that insulting another religion's prophet is actually beyond the pale? Really, you couldn't talk about that. Now, it may be that we'll go on believing that actually, no, it was just wrong, and everybody should just say it's wrong, and that's fine. So I'm not wishing to actually, you know, discuss that as a contentious issue, but I am saying that the terror and horror of those experiences, you know, the business of climbing out of a blitzed, bombed crater doesn't allow you any distance, you know. But we now have the space to consider what was the reality of that football match in the First World War, you know. And, you know, one of the stories that emerged was that actually it was quite useful to go across and the British to meet the Germans so they could check out where the snipers were from a closer, and the next day they could kill them. You know, that's a perspective which is less heroic than the one of the original story.
And there is an element, I think, certainly in recent events, and John touched on this when you were talking about Twitter from the trenches. You know, we never had Twitter from the trenches, if you like, but certainly in recent atrocities, we've had more or less instant live footage of those things occurring. Mm. So there's a very loose filter in terms of what we're seeing, how we're seeing it, how we're interpreting it. And that makes a huge difference because the lead time, if you like, to event and reaction is very, very, you know, very tight.
One of the most searing images in our lives and the lives of people like us has been those planes going into the Twin Towers. Those, you know, and they played for days, didn't they, on the news broadcast. They just played and played and played. And there comes a point where you can ask that. We don't forget the terror and the horror of all of that and so on, but does the image itself almost become an abstract thing? It almost becomes like a piece of avant-garde film work, you know. It's not. I know that would be a terribly cynical thing, but...
It's interesting you raise that about the Twin Towers, because there's also the anniversaries that we set up ourselves that we remember that are poignant to us, as well as the overarching time frame of other things that happen. And, you know, from a personal point of view, it's that always that question, where were you when?
Yeah.
What were you doing when?
Yeah.
And, you know, for the Twin Towers, I was standing looking in amazement into the Southern Electric shop in Gosport.
Right.
Because I'd just come out of an interview and I couldn't believe what was going on.
Yeah.
It's right, you don't forget certain things.
You don't.
You know, and certain things become memorable.
That's right.
And for whichever reason it is. And, you know, I think we also tell ourselves stories about our ancestors, our parents, you know, oh, it's 5 years since Mum died sort of thing. You know, it's about personal story. But with these bigger anniversaries, it's about where do we fit?
That's right.
How do we fit in? What do we contribute? Will people remember us when we're gone?
Yeah.
You know, it's those questions.
So there's an idea there, I guess, about a kind of, I suppose, a kind of emotional calendar, if you like, rather than a kind of chronological calendar. It's you know, you're marking time with significant events.
John and I are both visual artists. You know, there is something about making a piece of visual art that you feel it might live forever. And somehow, you know, even if you're not a famous, you know, you're not on the Royal Academy walls or something, you know, Tate Gallery, but it might live forever. It might be your eternity, mightn't it? Or, you know, I published a book, you know, so, you know, when I'm gone, the book will still be in Portsmouth Library, you know. And I think that same thing applies. You know, I can tell you, you know, where I was when Kennedy died or when I heard about it. It doesn't matter to the world in the slightest, but it actually places me in that piece of history. And John's absolutely right about that. And then we become a part of, you know, a real event.
Let's segue into a musical anniversary. Dave and I have a long-running battle on this programme about Bob Dylan. Blood on the Tracks was released on the 20th of January, 1975, okay, which is a long time ago, in fact, 40 years ago. I myself wasn't even on the planet. Now, this is a track called You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, Dave Allen, and our special guest, John Adams. And we're looking at anniversaries, commemorations, and celebrations, really significant points in history that we were marking throughout 2015. We're going to put a number of links to some of the topics and some of the dates, some of the milestones that we're picking out on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. But we're going to talk now about politics and about, I suppose, about political heritage. So I'm really excited by this. John, let's start by talking about Democracy Streets, which is a local project. It's going to be focused in Fratton. You and I are involved in the Fratton Big Local Partnership, which is officially one of the partners. But just outline the idea. What's the idea behind the project?
The idea is people taking part, people being involved, people making a difference. It kind of sprang out of a project I ran through the Olympics, which was when people come in for an arts project, let's say, and most people won't engage with it if they say, oh, I can't do that, I can't draw. So it was tasked for me to come up with a project that enabled people anywhere in the country, whatever level of skill, to join in. And the art was the conversations people had while they made things. And it wasn't focused on who did the best thing, who did that. It was kind of non-sectarian and equalised. And I guess this is kind of the same sort of thing. The project is made by individual people doing what they want to do, just joining in one brief moment with an app and pressing a button, but they're adding something bigger. They're adding to a larger artwork that will be made throughout between March, end of March, and November 2015.
So it's a kind of digital and kind of real-time art project.
Yes, it's digital. You know, we decided to go down the road of digitalness, but that's only the first port of call. Once you've marked your street, and the idea is to take a look at your area, take a look at your street and the streets around you, and determine whether they have a connection or a link with democracy.
So an obvious one in Portsmouth is Winston Churchill Avenue.
Yes. People like to know what's in a name. People like to know what's, you know, where they live. And I guess that's why also I joined Big Local, because as a resident, you know, you take a pride in your area.
Mm.
You take a pride in what's happened. I mean, we're, you know, talking about anniversaries, you know, you like to know what's gone on before, because that informs, you know, the present. But you take a pride in where you live. You want to make a difference. And I think the key words for the whole of Democracy Street is about people making a difference. Sometimes with politics, you know, people don't vote because they don't think they matter. They don't think they count. And that's really sad, because everybody should count. Everybody should have a say. Anybody can make a difference.
Well, that's really interesting, because I think one of the key drivers of this, from what I know about this project, is that element of participation and challenging that. I'm not sure apathy is the right word, but challenging those barriers that stop people from engaging in politics in a variety of ways. One of the things that the project through Houses of Parliament is trying to commemorate is the Magna Carta. 800 years yes. since the Magna Carta. I can remember sitting in a politics seminar at university with an American lecturer, and he sat back and he said, "Right, you first year politics students, tell me the significance of the Magna Carta." And there was a stunned silence, and I bravely put my hand up and I said, "Well, I think the significance of Magna Carta is that the power of the monarch is not absolute." And there was more stunned silence, because I'd actually got something right. But it, I suppose, really is about asserting the people's power, if you like, the power yeah. of a popular parliament. And that's kind of reinforced by, in 1265, you get what's known as the Montford, or de Montford Parliament, which is the first English parliament, yeah. so the kind of first popular yeah. assembly. And when we say popular, obviously there were a whole host of caveats around yeah. who could be in that chamber and who could vote and all those kind yeah. of things. But it was the seed of an idea, and that's what you're kind of trying to get back to, isn't it? That kind of popular dimension.
It applies in the field of art too. People think it's not for them and they can't join in, so anything that enables people to participate has to be a really good thing. You know, getting art out there for people to join in with. Yes, there are messages beneath this, you know, about, you know, taking a part, being, you know, a small piece in a jigsaw. You know, you're kind of vital, because, you know, the whole picture will be missing when you if you don't have all the pieces. But no, it is. It's to encourage people to participate. It's to encourage people to take an interest in their area. It's to encourage people that they can make a difference, whether that's for the general election in May. And, you know, Democracy Streets is a non-sectarian project. It's commissioned by Parliament rather than, you know, government. So, you know, I feel very privileged to have been chosen. I mean, I have Asperger's, and for some people that can be a bit difficult. But I've been chosen specifically because, as well as, you know, people joining in, they'll send data into us, you know, which of the streets, wherever they live. You know, you could, like you say, Winston Churchill Avenue. There are lots of Union streets. Union, which union is it named after? The union between England and Scotland. There's King Streets, Queen Streets. You know, then there's some named after Waterloo. There are a few that are quite rare. I mean, we have one Callaghan Drive up on the hill there, which mm-hmm. actually has no houses. An interesting thing about Winston Churchill Avenue is there is no street sign. It only exists on maps. So it's these little quirks that I want people to look at. Find out who named their street. Why was it named? Has it got something to do with democracy? What can I, you know, then when they've enjoyed, you know, engaged with us, then they can go on and write poetry about it, make some music about it, turn it into a community project that gets people together and talking. Because it's all very well looking and thinking you can make a difference unless you talk to other people, unless you engage with the community around you. And, you know, it's the community that makes a difference for the area they live in. Mm. And that's really important.
You mentioned Asperger's, and that fascinates me. And you said something earlier about how that affects your relationship with time. Just try and explore that a little bit for us.
Well, that's interesting to talk about with anniversaries too, because for me, my Asperger's comes with a couple of added gifts. It comes with dyslexia, which people might not consider a gift, but it's only a disability when other people want to make it a disability. And also synesthesia. Now, synesthesia is a cross-pollination of the senses, so instead of hearing music, I might hear it and taste it. And
you can smell light. Is that the kind of...
Yes, it's very similar to that, yes. You know, I can hear a space when I walk into it. I can taste colours, so yellow I find revolting, whereas a pale green I find okay. But there's an element of synesthesia in everyday language too. If you think about that, Thai is very loud. You know, there's something yeah, yeah. there. So, but it, one of the biggest things with my synesthesia is I can touch time. Now, that might feel very strange, but, you know, Wednesday's quite a big day. Saturday, Sunday's quite small and quite smooth. But it's not isolated. It is like a timeline. So I can put my hand behind me to feel yesterday and see last week and visualise the month before. And it's nice to know where things happen on that timeline. exactly like if you have anniversaries, it's nice to know what happens on those timelines. So the two anniversaries this year about the De Montfort Parliament, 750 years, and the 800th anniversary of the signing of the Magna Carta, sealing of the Magna Carta, are really quite important. You know, we were talking earlier about there's nobody alive. Well, obviously there's nobody alive, you know, to remember those and see those, but we're still marking it. We're still deeming it as important. The other thing I want people to look at when they do the project, then the project will go national. There are other big local areas who are going to join in, and, you know, we're hoping through Twitter and Facebook and other things that people will take part. They will send me digital information through the app, and part of my Asperger's is I can see patterns in data. So I will make new maps of democracy of Britain, and it encompasses, you know, suffragettes, levellers, all these different political periods.
I think that's fascinating because, you know, increasingly we live in a world where kind of data and numbers are essential to kind of, you know, anything we do, really. You know, the idea of the algorithm and the generation of choice, you know, and what you're describing is, I just find it fascinating in terms of how you as an individual relate to a dimension, let alone kind of time.
I've got two fairly practical questions, really. One is, where exactly is Fratton in terms of defining the project? And the other question is, given that it's a Parliament initiative, is it happening in other cities and towns as well, or is it unique to Fratton and Portsmouth?
The pilot scheme will be run in Fratton. Mm. Now, when I first joined Fratton Big Local, you know, you're looking at improving your local community, but it's also an element of support there. Mm. And when I was first given the opportunity to think about the project, I thought, well, this would be an ideal thing to do in Fratton, to trial it and then pass it out to other big local areas as almost a ready-made project that they can then use as a catalyst to engage with their community. So Fratton is the pilot, and it's important because we'll be, you know, basing what we do in the summer on how we engage with people and the ideas they give to us. You know, we will basically just, this is the project, how do you think we should, you know, it's a test, it's a trial, but yes, no, you're right, it's a national project. Anybody can join in with anywhere they've got a street.
There was just a thought in my mind about democracy in Fratton, which is that there is democracy in action in Fratton, except it's almost not in Fratton, but the best known national part of Fratton is Fratton Park. Mm. And Fratton Park is a classic example of a football club that 6 years ago won the FA Cup and is now, you know, 2 years ago was in complete disarray and it was saved democratically, you know. One of the finest examples, in a sense, of ordinary people just becoming activists, you know, and saying, we're not having this, you know, we're going to change this and transform it. And
well, that's really interesting, because if people believe in something, they'll stand up for it. And I'm not talking about doing something that's drastic. I'm just talking that the ordinary person has the opportunity to do something. Yeah. You were talking earlier about those, you know, these iconic moments of pictures that stay in our mind, like the Twin Towers. You know, that was people, that was mostly ordinary people with a smartphone, and they were in the right place at the wrong time or the wrong place at the right time. Yeah. Mm. And those images, you know, are now burnt, you know, and won't be forgotten.
No.
And, you know, people can make a difference. If you're in the right place at the right time, you can make a difference. It's more about believing in yourself that you matter. So there's things on lots of different levels, you know, that I want people to take in. And almost it's a confidence boost.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what the final artworks look like. They will happen. They will be made. But it's where it changes people socially, like a social chain reaction. And maybe people will take more of an interest instead of shutting their front door and thinking, we'll leave that to other people.
Now, there's more information on that specific project that you can find online at frattonbiglocal.org.uk. And we're going to broaden things out a little into the political realm now. And Dave, you plucked some choice events, if you like, that have a kind of, I suppose, an anniversary. I'm going to use the anniversary word, not a celebration or commemoration in our politics.
Yeah.
I suppose the first one is, it's 25 years since the release of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
Which was a massive political event.
Massive.
People never thought he would see the light of day again.
I think he's one of the great political figures of my lifetime. Possibly the greatest. You know, I mean, I was just about alive when Gandhi was still alive. There's certainly Martin Luther King. I know that there's a certain reverence for Kennedy, but I would say that King was more significant. And I think Mandela is just unbelievably extraordinary figure, really. You know, and as you say, it was very difficult to imagine it. An odd experience for me in some respects, because of course, as I say quite a lot, is I have this huge involvement and fondness for cricket, and cricket of course was one of the triggers, one of the levers, you know, because of their passion for international sport and the fact that they were ostracised and were not allowed to compete, not just in cricket but in other things as well. It wasn't that in the end changed it, but it was one of the levers, which is a quite, you know, quite peculiar idea in some respects. But that release, and I think his extraordinary humanity afterwards, that capacity for, you know, forgiveness and reconciliation, which was not in the slightest bit cynical, despite the fact that he was a politician. But I think John raised an interesting question or an interesting notion earlier about never again. You know, we must learn from these events, never again. And the sad truth is that the human race tends not to, does it? I think in South Africa, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it didn't learn from the extraordinary figure of Mandela. That other people were not somehow able to take on that mantle and behave in that way. And so there are lots of challenges for them.
The other event, which I'm going to dangerously put on the table, was that in 1975, 40 years ago, the United Kingdom had a referendum on joining what I think was called the Common Market, which nowadays, in popular parlance, is called the European Union.
And I voted in it.
You did. I wasn't around. Again, I wasn't around for that. But we won't ask you how you voted.
Well, I voted for it.
Oh, okay.
Well, you can ask me. I don't mind. I'd vote for it again today as well.
Okay. There's an interesting parallel with that event and events perhaps in this year's election. You know, we have a rise of a new popular party who is specifically against, you know, the kind of European Union membership.
Sure.
There's always something that gets lost, I think, in the history of this. So in 1975, it wasn't an in-out. It was a kind of renegotiate, kind of, you know, and very similar to the kind of current context, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a kind of, you know, it's conveniently forgotten that we'd been a member for 2 years. It wasn't about joining. It was saying, well, let's just kind of, you know, change it around a little bit. You know, that kind of
thing. It's interesting because we're talking now, and we've talked about Nelson Mandela. You know, do we use the S word, statesman, you know?
Yeah.
Do we use a very charismatic leader? And, you know, maybe what we're looking at now in politics aren't necessarily, they all seem to be very similar colours. Maybe now, you know, and you're talking about a new added interest this year, maybe that's about charismatic figures and what they're able to say. And it's interesting because if we look back 100 years ago at some of the anniversaries, well, even back to, you know, just the 50th anniversary of the death of Winston Churchill, that is probably one of my first memories is watching that on the telly, sort of 3-4 years old, and thinking, you know, wow, he must have been a great man. You know, what do we mean by a great man? Yeah. What do we mean by a really good leader? What do we mean by a charismatic figure? What do we mean by a statesman? And maybe, you know, some of this interest in democracy and looking back and seeing who your street is named after, you kind of look back and think, Gladstone. These people, you know, even the non-politicians like Charles Kingsley, he made a difference, you know, because of what he did with his book.
Yeah.
You know, he influenced the whole business about children and employment back, you know, in Victorian times. Who does that now?
Yeah.
Where does that happen? Where are our statesmen in politics now?
One of the points is that they do seem to be terribly alike. Well, one of the reasons that they're terribly alike is that to a very large extent, the key figures went to public school, went to Oxford University, all did PPE, whether they end up as Labour Party people or Conservative people, they've all done exactly the same thing. And in the interim, they've worked as political aides so that they are professional politicians, you know. I mean, you know, Winston Churchill and I wouldn't necessarily agree about a lot of things politically, but you know, you have to say that the guy was a great figure in the Second World War. But what happened before that? All kinds of things in his life. He went off and fought in the Boer War. You know, he escaped from prison camp and stuff like that. I mean, and I was mentioning earlier that I've just read the autobiography of Alan Johnson, who seems to me to be a very fine man and completely different. Grew up in abject poverty in Notting Hill Gate, and at the age of 16 went off and worked in the post office, you know. And the problem nowadays is that they are all coming out of the same stamp. So when you suddenly get, you know, these quirky figures, they don't always survive, do they? I mean, Galloway is a classic example on the other side, and people are attracted by this quirkiness, strangeness, difference, and then you begin to dig under the surface and give them a bit of time, and, you know, the same thing may happen with Farage, you know, and I've no idea whether it will or not, perhaps, you know. Incidentally, I mean, I've made those comments about Europe. It doesn't follow from that that I think everything is fine there, perfect. So I understand absolutely why the charisma is attached to, you know, quite legitimate complaints about endless bureaucracy, waste of money, etc. You know, understand that completely, you know, makes lots of sense.
You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, Dave Allen and John Adams. And we're looking at anniversaries, celebrations, commemorations, significant milestones for 2015. And we're moving on to focus on Dave's favourite area, pop culture. I think that's your middle name now, isn't it? I think possibly, but
pop.
but you've picked out some, I think, some really interesting dates.
There are lots. There is, in fairness, something that you sent to me about albums. You know, released with a date with five at the end of it, and you've got to push. And we played Bob Dylan earlier, and it's interesting that there are two Bob Dylan albums that came out 50 years ago this year. And again, you know, the question is, does that matter? I mean, if they'd come out 49 years ago, would they be any less significant? No. But what it does do is it invites you to think about those particular artifacts and say, well, Highway 61 Revisited and bringing it all back home are quite major. And in the same respect, and given that there is this, it seems to me, extraordinary idea that Bob Dylan's new album next month is going to be covers of Frank Sinatra, I mean, I guess it's true, everybody's saying it. 100 years ago this year, come December, was the birth of Frank Sinatra. And my bet would be that the media and popular entertainment will probably go to town on that. And there will be, I would not be surprised to see a great many people claim Frank Sinatra to be the great popular singing voice of the 20th century, the whole 20th century. Whether you agree with that or not, I will not be surprised if that's the claim people make.
If Barry Manilow can make a duets album with dead people, anything is possible, is all I'm saying. There are some other things that you mentioned, the Birdcage earlier on, which is, I know, a topic close to your heart. And there's close a significant heart, kind of anniversary here.
Yeah, well, it was end of February on a Thursday evening down in Osborne Road in Southsea, where the casino is now, almost by Queen's Hotel. It was then Kimball's Ballroom, and a guy called Ricky Farr and a chap called Robin Best came from Brighton, and they basically they didn't want to open a club in Brighton because they thought this was around the mod scene, which is exemplified in films like Quadrophenia. They didn't think Brighton was a go because there was already quite a lot of stuff going on. London was pretty packed. Where were they going to go? And they came along the coast and they saw that there was some stuff going on in a sort of ad hoc way in Portsmouth, and they went for Portsmouth. And and they, you know, they had really considerable success. For when you look back on it now, you think it wasn't actually that long. You know, opened in February 65 and by August 67 it had shut. But for people of almost precisely my generation, which means that you were probably born between 1946 and 1950, no later than that, it was an amazing place, you know. So the first played, there was a DJ there who played really quite hot releases from American, Black American soul, Tamla, everything that was new. He got imports in every week, and so you were hearing stuff that some of it is now called Northern Soul and people go on about it, but we were hearing it in 65 66. The acts were not always kind of major pop acts. So the first act to play there was Gary Farr and the T-Bones, who weren't a major act, but they made a couple of albums, appeared on Ready, Steady, Go. But you did gradually, as you look at it, you know, get some really major names. So Rod Stewart played there very early days, for example, with Long John Baldry, Julie Driscoll. The Who played there three or four times. The Small Faces played there, Little Richard, Wilson Pickett, so on, so on, so on. Early Pink Floyd turned up with light shows in the days when the mod soul thing was being transformed into psychedelia and early kind of hippie. So for a particular generation, and it is my generation, and for people with particular musical tastes, it was a phenomenal experience. And it is, you know, it is 50 years ago this year. Do we think celebrating anniversaries around precise numbers is necessary, useful, important, so on?
You were talking earlier as well about, I suppose delicately we'll put a kind of revealing anniversary, about something that first appeared in the cinema.
I think it's really funny, this, because, you know, one of the things that people will always say, I think, about the mass media, television, cinema and so on is, why is it necessary that it gets more explicit? Why do we have more violence than we used to? Why do we have more sex than we used to? And so on, so on, so on. People didn't used to take their clothes off in the 1970s. And so, well, it is this year the centenary, 100 years since the first nude woman appeared in a Hollywood movie, and her name was Audrey Munson. I'm sorry to say, even though I once taught film studies, I've never seen the movie. But she was there without her clothes.
It's interesting because in a way it would be difficult to commemorate that, wouldn't it, in some ways? What could you do?
Well, we could all take our clothes off.
Well, we could. On radio, that might not work.
Well, should we tell them John sat there without his clothes? No, it wouldn't work very well.
Some interesting pictures on the blog.
What would you... Yes, I've not actually seen even a photograph. I don't know, in all truth, whether the footage still... Because it would have been of silent black and white, wouldn't it, in 1915. But I don't know if it still exists even. But that's the sort of thing you'd take on faith, really. I mean, I guess it's true. I'm more fond myself of that's in November. The other great one in November for me, I think one of the great works of English literature really is the 150 years since the publication of Alice in Wonderland, which is a fabulous book. The only thing that has always intrigued me about Alice in Wonderland, maybe this is a personal view and I'm not sure if it's true, but it always seems to me like it's a brilliant visual thing. And I like the drawings that are in the original book and so on. But I've never seen a really successful film or television production of it. It never seems quite to work. I don't have a clear view as to why that would be. You know, maybe it is just very literary, because there's a lot of words. He's doing clever stuff with words, isn't he?
I suppose the most recent kind of incarnation was the Tim Burton.
It was.
With Johnny,
and it's okay,
Johnny
I
Depp.
Think. It's okay.
It wasn't very well received, was
no,
it? And
it wasn't.
I think what you've highlighted is probably one of the reasons. Mm. You know, it is very literal, it is very wordy, it's very rhythmic, and it's very difficult to put that across in a Hollywood blockbuster.
I think that's probably
you can make
right.
it look great and different, but actually it's the content, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. And very funny on all kinds of levels. It's very funny on the level of nonsense, but it's also very funny on the level of poking fun at priggishness and pompousness and, you know, self regard and all of those things. It's quite lovely, really. Yeah.
And lots of it is still embedded in our language, you know, kind of Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Oh,
I was,
sure.
You know, the other day it was a reference to the current Prime Minister and Chancellor on the radio. Yeah. It's still there. It's still kind of it's still embedded, as it were.
The other controversial thing out of popular culture from 50 years ago, the Beatles released their album Rubber Soul and their film Help, but they were also awarded MBEs, and that outraged some members of the establishment. Some people actually sent theirs back, didn't they, and said, if you're giving them to them, I don't want one. And I mean, that seems a funny idea now, because we quite happily give those sorts of awards to those sorts of celebrities, but at the time, you know, it was seen as outrageous by the establishment.
I guess it's that moment of the revolution where you become the establishment, isn't it? It's that kind of idea.
Yeah.
So, one film I wanted to mention, and it's a significant film for me because I can remember watching it at primary school. That's how long ago it was for me. In 1985, Back to the Future appeared. An amazing film. And actually, it's probably one of my favourite films. The more and more I think about it, the more I kind of warm to the film. It's a science fiction film. I doubt there are many people that have not seen this film. If you haven't seen it, go out and find a copy, because it's universally available. It was Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale's idea of... it was a kind of play on what would it be like to meet your parents when they were young. Okay, so a young teenager basically befriends a crazy scientist and uses a time machine to go back in time. Goes back to 1955, a significant year for a whole host of reasons. In some ways, the birth of rock and roll, or certainly the kind of generation of a scene. He goes back in time and he confuses his own history, and he has to try and put that right. There's a very quick summary of that film. The reason I wanted to raise it was it is amazingly now 30 years since it was made, which is, for me, is massive. You know, I can't quite believe it's 30 years ago. It was also, in 1985, the biggest grossing film of the year. It took $383 million, which at the time was again, a massive figure. Yeah. But what I'm getting to here is the most significant thing about this is it was successful and they made two sequels. And in part two, Back to the Future part two, they go forward to the future of 2015. Okay, so if you see a DeLorean speeding round Slindon Street with flames behind it, be very, very worried. But it's really interesting how they play with the idea of what the future will look like and what we'll be doing in the future. And actually, it's a smart film in the way that I think Blade Runner is a smart film, in that it uses or tries to develop pretend technologies based on things we're already doing. So in Blade Runner, I think the best example is the video disc. You know, you can very clearly in one scene see Deckard putting a disc into a computer or drive, and it's a video disc. There are six things in Back to the Future in 2015 that we actually have. It's very exciting. I've done a bit of research to find them. This is according to a website called digitalspy.co.uk. Again, we'll put links on our blog. The six things that actually exist in 2015 from Back to the Future are video calling and smart TV. All of us, I think, probably use Skype, have a tablet or some kind of smart television thing that we watch. The other idea linked to that is the connected home. You can see very clearly in Back to the Future 2, houses are automated. They do their own things. The Internet of Things is a reality. They didn't know that that's what it would look like in 30 years' time, but it's a really, really astute guess, I think. Hoverboards. I couldn't believe this, but the hoverboard exists. So a skateboard that can hover. You won't find one on Clarence Pier, sadly, or next to Clarence Pier, but the hoverboard actually exists. A skateboard that can be powered by a motor that pushes it off the ground.
I'd like one of them.
A cushion of air. I'll get you one of those for Christmas.
Yeah.
The self-lacing Nike trainer. Okay. Now, I haven't got a pair of them in the studio, unfortunately. But in 2011, Nike, the sports manufacturer, made a pair of the boots that Marty McFly wears in the film, but they weren't self-lacing. They couldn't quite get the self-lacing technology, but in 2015, this year, they're poised to produce a pair. Okay, so we'll watch that very excitedly. 3D cinema appears in Back to the Future, Back to the Future 2. Jaws 19 can be seen playing in the cinema behind him when he's running through Hill Valley. And the last thing, and actually this is very subtly introduced into the film, but again very clever, the tablet computer. Okay, there are a number of teachers and other significant characters in the films that very subtly have a piece of glass with information on it and a computer screen. And now, you know, those are kind of commonplace things, aren't they? Most of us have a smartphone and a tablet and, you know, all kinds of different things. So it's a great film, and it's also a great opportunity for me, an excuse for me, to play a little snippet of Huey Lewis and the News. So that was the great Huey Lewis and the News. Whatever happened to them? I think they're still touring at some strange venues. Anyway, we're coming to the end of our themed special, if you like, around anniversaries and looking at 2015 in terms of the milestones that it collects around art, culture, music, poetry, film, all the kind of significant things in our life. And I think we're kind of coming to a place where we've got to consider how much the view of the future affects the future, but also how much kind of science and technology influences that or is influenced by it. It's a very difficult debate. We're going to try and wrap it up. John, this is never an easy one to broach, is it, in terms of how much does our view of the future actually influence and change the future?
It's really interesting. If you look at films, you know, from the 50s, 60s, Star Trek, Forbidden Planet, their visions of the future were very firmly rooted in their time. But when you get on to the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, there are things introduced into films like those ideas from Back to the Future. Then does a scientist take that idea, run with it and make it reality? Or are the filmmakers looking at things that scientists are inventing at the time and thinking, I might find a use for it? If we go back to the Second World War, most technology was driven by the needs of the time about, the war advancing. But now I think the media plays a really important part of that, and what people vision, artists and filmmakers envision of the future, I think is becoming slightly more truer, because I think we're making the future look more like what people imagine.
It's really interesting to think now what in 30 years' time we'll all be using on a kind of day-to-day basis. You know, at the moment there's this idea, fascinating idea called Centaur technologies, okay? So a Centaur technology is something that combines the human and the mechanical, okay? So you can imagine half man, half horse, if you like. But the key is, how is it applied? You know, I wouldn't have believed when I was at primary school watching Back to the Future that I could phone a friend of mine or I could see a friend of mine who's in India on something in my pocket. Wouldn't have believed it.
I'm going to kind of turn it round just for my last comment. And I'm not disagreeing with either of you guys. I entirely endorse that. And there will be things that will be, whether I'll live long enough to see all those extraordinary things, goodness only knows. But there's a thing that's fascinated me in the last 12 months, which is where technological invention, the media and industry come together and predict things and comment about things and so on, and actually miss a key point. And the thing that I've absolutely loved in the last year is the news that for the first time in something like 15 years, sales of vinyl albums have gone up. Because if the media, technologists and industry had their way, there would be no such thing, and there wouldn't be anything to play them on either. But there is. And I think it's quite wonderful. Because what it reminds us is, don't make too many assumptions. Because actually, people might still play acoustic guitars. They might still paint with oil paint. That, you know, they might still play vinyl.
This year for me is the 40th anniversary when I really started getting into music. And at the time it was John Peel playing Tangerine Dream, early Virgin records. The album was important. They weren't singles. They were just single sides of the album. And at those times it was very difficult to get into music. I tried then. But if we come right to the future now, I can pick up an iPad and I can make music. And I've probably got more power on my iPad than they had on at any point in stage. And, you know, going back to the synthesizers from the 70s and early 80s, analog synthesizers are now back in vogue.
Yeah.
You know, so we've taken the digital bit, we've done that, we've got digital on iPads, but we've also got analog synthesizers.
Got the best of everything.
Exactly.
Which is lovely.
I think that's it.
Yeah, which is lovely.
We should all be reassured by the fact that there is plenty of space in the fridge next to Walt Disney for all of us to wake up in 2115.
No thanks.
Have a good look. Just before we go, we've just got time to flag a few events locally that are occurring around Portsmouth area. If you're interested in LGBTI rights, you can go along to a free lecture from Peter Tatchell on the 11th of February at 6 o'clock in the Portland building. If you want more details on that, you can find them on the University of Portsmouth website.
I've got three events coming this week, actually. Wednesday, the 28th, at the Guildhall, a charity event for Parkinson's called Stuff and Nonsense, which has been organised by a very good pal of mine, Stuart Oleska, and it features Harry Hill, Neil Innes from the Bonzos, Sheila Hancock, and some live video links or some video recorded links. So that's that night. And then the next night, Thursday the 29th, at the Cellars in Eastney, a kind of anticipating the 50th anniversary of the Birdcage, one of their most regular visitors is Chris Farlow. Hit recordings in the 60s, still going strong, and he's playing the Cellars on Thursday night. And then Friday, January the 30th, the Art Cafe Lodge in Victoria Park, a concert for Palestine with the Polite Mechanicals, songs and tunes from England and elsewhere with accordion, fiddle, banjo, guitar and double bass, plus Palestinian oud player Ayman Youssef, with all proceeds for medical aid for Palestinians. So three nights in a row, go out and have loads of fun.
Excellent stuff. You can also catch Kate Tempest at the Wedgwood Rooms on the 7th of February at 8 o'clock. Tickets are £12.50, and you can call their box office on 023 9286 3911. Also, I think I just must mention that Saturday the 7th of February is National Libraries Day 2015. Something to be commemorated and celebrated. Yeah. So get out and use your library. My thanks as ever to Dave Allen, and also thanks to our great guest, John Adams. Thanks, John, for coming in. We'll put all of the information on the blog. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.